Well, I had a head start because there were a lot of people that came before me, Robin, and they had developed field expeditions in places like the White Sea, in places like Newfoundland, in places like Namibia, in places like, of course, right here at home, the Ediacara Hills of the Flinders Ranges. So it was a matter for me in the beginning, when I just thought this was the hottest thing I'd come across, to go and visit some of these places. And I found most of them were being very well taken care of, thank you very much. And one place that wasn't, that I've gotten really involved in, is Namibia, because there weren't too many people working there, so that's where I've spent a good bit of my time.
Before we go to Namibia, let's go to a place I actually do know reasonably, and that's the Flinders Ranges and the Ediacara. You're telling me you've just been there with David Attenborough, doing what?
Well, David Attenborough is doing a documentary on our book. And so he is going around at the moment visiting all of the major sites, and Ediacara Hills in the Flinders Ranges is certainly one of the really key sites. So he was there, he's been in Newfoundland, and now we're trying to get him to go to the other two sites, which is Namibia and also the White Sea of Russia.
It's not bad for your mid-80s with a dodgy knee, is it?
He's absolutely amazing. Totally amazing.
Now, about the Ediacara, Stephen Jay Gould, famously the person who used to be at Harvard, he always used to describe Ediacara as an experiment that was kind of called off, and he said that here are examples of a huge number of different sorts of creatures that existed and then were wiped out, and they could have led to other creatures, but they were an experiment that never kind of continued. Would you agree with him on that?
I'd partially agree with him on that, but it's a mixture of things in the Ediacara. You find things that are so bizarre that you still don't even know what's up and down, back and forward, and what in the world they were doing. And those are the things we call pterodinium and Urnieta, named after a famous farmer. But there are things like Kimberella, which may well have something to do with mollusks. And it had habits of grazing. It had a shell that was made out of something that was flexible, but it wasn't calcium carbonate. You've got other things that look like it may be related to trilobites. And so it's a mixture. So if you say Ediacarans, it's a mixed bag. Stephen, a classmate of mine at Columbia, was absolutely right that some of them just failed. They did very well for several tens of millions of years, and then kaput, they're gone. But there are others that I think were related to the ancestors, things that came in the Cambrian.
And the Flinders Ranges in South Australia, that is one of the world capitals of Ediacara?
Absolutely, and it's the name. That's where the name Ediacara came from. And it's probably the critical place for finally recognizing that these things were pre-Cambrian. Big argument going on for quite a long time. Many, many places where these animals were found before that, in Namibia, for example. But the real recognition that these things were older than the Cambrian, I think South Australia certainly played a major role in that. And Reg Sprigg played a major role in that.
Tell me about Reg Sprigg.
Oh, Reg Sprigg's my hero. Absolute hero. He found these. In fact, I had the privilege of going back and going through all of his field notes, which were full of all kinds of interesting scientific information and some of the best jokes I've ever read. But he, in 1946, found material in the Flinders Ranges that he thought was pre-Cambrian and that he thought were very unusual animals. And he certainly had that in his notes. But it took a while to get people convinced that, in fact, they were pre-Cambrian and that they were really strange animals.
And, of course, now the Ediacara are an age in themselves. It's talked about the Ediacaran age.
Yes, indeed. And the type section for that geologic period is in the Flinders Ranges, in the Ediacara Hills. And it has been officially, in 2004, set up as a particular time period in the Precambrian.
Are there still plenty of fossils to be discovered there, do you think?
Oh, yeah. And there's plenty of fossils to be discovered everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, are they very common in that particular part of Australia?
Yeah, they are. And one of the problems is they need to be protected because they are our heritage. And so Jim is doing a great job looking after that. And some of the graziers out there as well, Robin, are very protective of them.
Okay, take me to Namibia. The pictures in your book show it as an incredibly arid place, a very dramatic place, which is very convenient, of course, for people who are looking for fossils, because there they are sticking out of the surface of the earth. A tremendous trove.
It's absolutely great. I mean, I'm a conservationist and I like trees, but when I am a geologist, I really like to go to deserts because you do have these outcrops that go for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. And I don't know, when you get to Namibia and you're out there in the middle of nowhere, it's just such a uplifting experience. And it's probably the area where humanity first met the Ediacarans, because our history goes a long way back in Africa, longer than it does here in Australia. And there are rock carvings on the property where we're working that are almost exact replicas of some of the fossils that we find in the rocks that are Ediacarans. Dating those, how do you date a rock carving? It's kind of difficult. But the Nama people have been there for a very, very long time. And I suspect, looking at some of the shelters that they've built that have the fossils in them, and then seeing the rock carvings, and they obviously are the things that we're looking at, that it's special to me because I think it's first human contact. Can't prove it, but it really speaks of that to me.
Wonderful shapes, the Ediacarans, and in your book, some pictures of creatures that look almost like leaves sticking out of the ground. What are they?
Well, you're probably talking about rhombiomorphs, which are the things that are very, very long-lived. They're like, I don't know if most of your listeners would have heard of Lingula, which is a brachiopod that seems to have lived for almost 500 million years. The rhombiomorphs are the long-lived Ediacarans. They show up in the really old rocks of Newfoundland, which are 580 million, and they're still around at 542, and then they're gone. And they do look like leaves. And we don't have any indication that they moved, so one of the pillars of Animalia is pulled out from under them. But they were very complicated, they had huge amounts of surface area, and they don't exactly look like a leaf. They're not flat, they're very three-dimensional, so we still puzzle over exactly what they were, even though I would at the moment, if I were down, in Nevada making bets, I would probably put my bet on animal rather than plant.
We're talking about creatures that lived under the water, aren't we?
Yes, marine.
Because even though it's desert now, then it was marine.
It was marine.
And what are you looking for these days when you go back for 1 month a year?
Anything I can find.
Okay, you arrive there, you go to South Africa, you take another plane, you drive out to the desert, and presumably you've got your own favourite sites.
We're looking for as many different ways that these things can be preserved as possible, but quite frankly, my next expedition is a continuation of what we did last time and this year, and that is to very carefully map the kinds of environments that these things occur in, and to very carefully date exactly what date we've got.
That's what I was going to ask you. How on earth you can find a fossil remain if they're all squishy with no bones?
Well, they aren't without bones. And in fact, I've just rewritten a script for somebody because they said, oh, they're soft. Well, they're soft, but they are tough and they're stiff, a lot of them. Many of them, even though they leave imprints, that's what you normally find, although you sometimes find fillings. These things were stiff and really not completely deformable. Many, many ideas, but I think cellulose may have played a major role in them because some animals do have cellulose.
Wow. Now, I'm going to ask you something that, going back to guessing, you won't particularly like. The Cambrian, huge explosion of different forms of animals. This was not just the rise of the animals, it was the explosion of the animals. How do you go from your era with all those nice squishy things and the Ediacara to this completely different revolutionary part of evolution?
Well, first of all, Richard Forte, famous guy who studies trilobites and is a great friend of mine, made the point that this revolution took about 30 million years. So, in human terms, that's a long time. And one of the things that happened at this time, too, was there was a fair bit of change over millions of years in sea ocean chemistry. So the chemistry, I think, became conducive to the deposition of shells for organisms that could deposit them. Now, John Shergold, who used to work at BMR in Canberra, came up with an interesting idea. He said with things that were going on at this time, his idea was that there was a fair bit of upwelling in the oceans and there was a lot of phosphate that became available in the ocean basins. Animals use phosphate in a cycle called the Krebs cycle and other ones, metabolic, and they need access to this. So maybe the first skeletons were actually deposited as a source of something you need in your metabolic system, and when it became available, then animals or whatever started depositing it. Now, what happened at that time, too, was not suddenly, but over millions of years, eyes developed. So there were eyes around, and things could see, and things could target. Predators developed. So there was an availability of the right kinds of things in the oceans in order to deposit skeletons. And there was a real emphasis that it would be a good idea if you could do that, not just for giving yourself a metabolic resource, but also, I could babble on about this, but there's a concept called the Verdun syndrome. If you have things that are after you, like in World War I, and you want to survive, you put on armor and you dig holes. And that's exactly what happened across this 20, 30 million years. And that's when a lot of different body types showed up. But I'm not so sure that they showed up first then. I think they showed up in part because things were laying down hard skeletons and they were preserved.
The Rise of Animals, the title of the book in which Professor Pat Vickers-Rich has a chapter on that work in Namibia and South Australia. So those shells may have started out as mineral stores and only later become shields.